About a year ago, I was attending a function for some ministers. And at my table, seated next to me, was a minister that I had not met before, a woman. And we talked, and we discovered that we had a mutual acquaintance. Now, I knew this acquaintance socially, and this woman knew this person through a business venture. Now, this minister that I was talking with was African American, and she was describing to me a particular business dealing that she had had with this man and how it had been rather odd. Her implication was that he had acted in a certain way because she was black and he was white. I said to her, "Yeah, I know this man, and he can be difficult, but I really don't think that he is racist." And she said to me, "Well, maybe not, but he certainly is not anti-racist." Now, I have to admit, I had never heard that term before, anti-racist, but I understood her meaning immediately. And I reflected on it for a moment, and I agreed with her, saying, "Yes, you're probably right. He wasn't." Now, since that conversation, which took place a year ago, I have come to hear and encounter this word more frequently, and I have come to appreciate that it is a powerful concept. So what exactly is anti-racism? One definition that I like defines anti-racism as, quote, "the practice of identifying, challenging, and changing the values, structures, and behaviors that perpetuate systemic racism." I like that it defines anti-racism as a practice. That means something that we should be doing continually, in which we identify and we challenge and we change those unjust behaviors in our society which perpetuate systemic racism. That mutual acquaintance, the one I mentioned a moment ago, I argued that I did not believe him to be racist. He could be difficult with anybody, regardless of race. But he was also a man of wealth and success and influence. And while probably not a racist, I never knew this man to use his influence to oppose the racism in our society. And he was certainly in a position to do so if he so desired. There is a book that I believe a majority of us have read, and that is the novel To Kill a Mockingbird. Written by Harper Lee and published in 1960, this book won the Pulitzer Prize in 1961. It has become required reading for several generations of middle schoolers, largely because it tells its story through the memories of a six-year-old girl. Oprah Winfrey has tagged this book as America's novel. To Kill a Mockingbird is one of my favorites, and every 5 or so years I will find my old ratty paperback from middle school and I'll reread it. The story is set in the 1930s. In the fictional South Alabama town of Macomb, the seat of Macomb County. In reality, the town is actually Monroeville, Alabama, which was Harper Lee's home. And her story centers on the Finch family. The daughter, Scout, who's the narrator, she starts out at 6 years old, her older brother, Jim, and their father, Atticus. In the novel, a black man named Tom Robinson is accused of raping a white woman. And from the start, emotions in the town explode. Atticus Finch is an attorney and is assigned to represent Tom. Tom Robinson in his defense. And he does so even in the face of violent racist opposition from those in town. And although during the trial, Atticus proves that Tom Robinson is clearly innocent of the charges, the jury still convicts him. Atticus vows to appeal the verdict as Tom is taken away. Sadly, some days later, Tom attempts an escape from prison and is shot and killed by the guards. For me, reading this book, Atticus Finch has always been a hero. He stands strong and does what is right in the face of rabid opposition. He is a man of good character. And today, it's not at all difficult to find an attorney who will confess that they were inspired to study law because of Atticus Finch. He represents what is noble of their profession. Recently, I was listening to an interview with an African-American writer. This writer explained that she truly loved this novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. However, she wanted to challenge its readers to reconsider the heroic nature of Atticus Finch. Was he a good man? Yes, absolutely. Was he a hero? Maybe not. Atticus Finch, she said, was not racist. That is clear in the book. He strives to protect his children even from racist influences. Nonetheless, this writer argues, Atticus Finch was not anti-racist. Every action he takes is good, but it's framed within the existing system, within the social system, within the legal system. He only takes the Robinson case when it is assigned to him by the judge. And he does an excellent job of defending Robinson. He even protects Robinson from a lynch mob one night. But Atticus only operates within his system. He does nothing to actually change the system. This character, Atticus Finch, does not meet this definition of anti-racism by identifying, challenging, and changing the value structures and behaviors that perpetuate the systemic racism around him. He is a good man, but he's not a hero. And the novel concludes with the young girl Scout reflecting on how their lives went back to normal after that turbulent summer. Nothing really changed. Today, we continue our excursion through the oracles of the prophet Amos. In the 7th century BC, Amos was a farmer and a shepherd and was called by God from his home in Judah to take God's message to the people of Israel. And so he travels north to Samaria, which is the capital of Israel, and there he preaches and he indicts the wealthy and the powerful of that nation for their sinful actions and their rejection of God. He decries the way they have perverted justice, how they've abused the poor for their profit. And the refrain throughout this book is a continuing warning of God's judgment, that God will bring ruin on these people if they do not change their ways. In today's reading from chapter 6, we again hear of God's impending judgment, of when these people shall be put into exile and their cities destroyed. Each Monday, I meet with a group of pastors, and we discuss the passages that we intend to preach on the coming Sunday. And this week, after I presented this section of Amos to them, they all looked at me, and they asked if I was angry with my congregation. What had my church done to deserve a reading like this? And I laughed because I had wondered the same thing. What people deserve this continuing onslaught of God's judgment that we find here in Amos? It is relentless. And it contains no obvious offering of hope. And we as Christians, we're accustomed to finding a bit of hope and grace mixed in with our judgment. God threatens to punish, but God also promises our forgiveness. But not in Amos. In Amos, we find that it is all smite all the time. In chapter 6, Amos focuses on the idle rich. And by idle, I mean that quite literally, because these people lie on their beds and they lounge on their couches and they eat the finest meats. And as they dine, musicians perform for them. They drink wine and they wash themselves with exquisite oils. These people, Amos tells us, they are the notable of the land. They are the upper class. And yet, they spend their time lounging about, gorging on fine foods, and exhibiting no concern whatsoever for the overall well-being of the people of their land. These people are complacent. They are oblivious. Their very lives are a rejection of God. They're not unlike the rich man in the parable, which is told by Jesus. You know, the rich man that lived a life of luxury while just outside his house, there was a beggar named Lazarus who was starving and was covered in sores. And Lazarus, all he wanted was to just eat some of the crumbs that fell off the table of the rich man in the nice house. Amos accuses the wealthy of turning justice into poison, of turning the sweet taste of righteousness into something that is bitter. God is angry, and God swears judgment on these people. But God's anger does not mean that God hates these people. God is angry because God loves. And because God is love, when an individual or a group causes others to suffer, well, God is grieved. God's judgment is not simply punishment. Its purpose is to motivate people to change. God doesn't delight in anger. God delights in being merciful and forgiving. God delights when justice rolls across the land like a mighty river. As we experience these words of Amos, it is difficult to place ourselves in the story. Who are we in this story? Are we the affluent, living in our fine mansions and indifferent to the plight of the poor and of the oppressed? Or do we see ourselves completely outside the bounds of the story and innocent of all these sins that Amos describes? We haven't done any of those things. Well, in reality, we're probably somewhere in the middle. Not sinless, but not as sinful as those that Amos rails against. At least, I hope not. But even in the middle, does God have cause to be angry with us for being idle? As a church, we do many good and kind acts. We provide food and shelter to those in need. We strive to be people of good character, even God character. But is that enough? Baskets of food are only band-aids for hunger. A bed for the night won't eradicate homelessness. Should we be stepping out of our comfort zones and addressing the root causes of hunger and poverty and homelessness and gender inequality and racism and the many other expressions of injustice in our world? Should we step outside our system? This summer, protesters have been flooding America's streets, calling for change. Their actions, well, they make many of us uncomfortable. And sometimes it's a challenge to empathize with their passion. However, I've decided that I'm going to view these protesters not as pests, but as prophets, and see them as being like Amos, with a job that is to make us uncomfortable, to shine a light on injustice and suffering, to identify injustice, to challenge the system, to bring about change. Their voices may make us squirm, but the sound, I believe, is music to God's ears. I've spoken about the lack of a message of hope in this book of Amos. That's not entirely correct. At the end of the book, we will discover an oracle of hope. But not just there, because the book itself is a statement of hope. Even in these dreary, hard-hitting passages that we've been plowing through, the book is an appeal to a lost people to return to their God. A God who is waiting for them to come back. A God who welcomes them despite how far they've traveled away. And remember, God sent this prophet Amos with his message, not of doom, but of salvation. The people only need to listen. God sent the prophet and many more, and even his son, because God is love. The very presence of the prophet is an assurance of hope. The very presence of this book is an assurance of hope. It is a reminder of God's love for us. And so, may we hear this message as a message of hope. May we then respond and shatter the cycles of injustice. May we not be idle. Amen.